Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Dispatch from the Zombie Apocalypse. I'm Jason Scorse. Hope everybody's doing great, and the new year is continuing to offer good things for you and provide good opportunities for you. So I left the last episode with a suggestion and a plea to not be lazy in our thinking, because it's really lazy thinking that has got us into the messes that we're in, or at least a lot of it's due to lazy thinking. And there's certainly no shortage of that out there. So this episode is dedicated to how not to be lazy with statistics. And I'll look at a few key issues and elaborate a little bit more beyond just the statistical nature, but kind of on the policy nature of these issues. And let me be clear here that while the right wing purposefully lies with statistics, well, much of the right wing just lies blatantly. They're not even trying to actually use and bend data to their will. They're just blatantly lying all day, every day. There are many in journalism who are simply misinforming and really doing a huge disservice to the body politic out of laziness. So they're presenting things that are based loosely on facts, but in such a way that they actually misinform. And so that's really what this episode is going to be focused on, is how to see through this and think a little deeper so that you're not misinformed and so you get actually what's going on in some of the big issues of the day. And before we get to the specific issues, which are going to cover tax policy, given the GOP's passage of the tax bill, it's good to kind of look at some of the misinformation around tax policy. And we'll get into approval polls, and we'll look at how those are used to misinform. And then I'll end on the issue of Obama counties, the counties that voted for Obama in 2008 and or 2012 and then flipped to Trump. And there's this kind of meme going around that somehow that proves that Trump's rise in popularity is not due to racism. And as you can gather, I will poke holes and destroy that nonsense, because it is nonsense. But before we do that, I just want to make the general point that the reason this is so important, it comes back to a kind of a basic fact about American life, which is that the status quo relies on misinformation and confusion. Because remember, all they need is business as usual, right? All the status quo and the powers that be need is, they don't even need radical change. Even the tax bill that just passed that's going to, you know, shower them with riches, they were already being showered with riches. And they already were, you know, had everything tilted and rigged in their favor. It's more rigged now and more in their favor, but it's not like it fundamentally changes anything. If nothing changed in America for here on for the next 50 years, the rich and powerful would be just fine, because they benefit from the status quo. And so therefore, it's really, really important that those of us who are trying to challenge and change the status quo know the facts and know the issues and know how to read statistics and present them in a way that inform people. This is just, you know, kind of basics of, you know, community organizing, a political organizing, a political messaging 101. As much as statistics and data is not the key to moving forward, in the sense that many people just don't have the time or inclination to understand this stuff, you know, those of us who really want to lead some of these efforts, we have to know what we're talking about. We have to have a basic grasp of the facts. And the reality is that America as a society is failing, right? We're growing more unequal. We're not living up to the challenge of climate change. Our legal system is unjust. Our education system is failing. Our infrastructure is failing. You know, those of us with money who live in nice places are doing fine, but as a nation, we're failing. And our healthcare system's failing. The opioid epidemic is failing white working class communities, and their life expectancy is actually going down for 2 consecutive years. And that is actually one area where my former guest Ken Stern is correct, right? For many white working class communities, their life prospects are getting worse. So the first step is not being lazy and understanding how to interpret policy and statistics and get our head in the game correctly. So after the break, we'll start talking about taxes. Okay, so let's move on to our discussion here about taxes. And the first thing you will notice when taxes come up, especially on right-wing media, Fox News, is you'll hear the statement that the rich pay the disproportionate share of federal taxes, and therefore that is evidence that they are overtaxed and that that burden should be relieved. And as you can imagine, that is complete nonsense and propaganda on a couple levels. But let's just start out with the fact that, yes, factually it is true that the rich pay more taxes than the rest of us, and disproportionately so, but not because of the reason the right wing would have us believe. The reality is that the rich pay most of the taxes because they have most of the money, not because of an unfair tax system. And let's just take a simple mathematical example, as easy as can be, which is, let's imagine a society with me and Bill Gates as its two members. Let's assume that the right-wing fantasy of flat taxation is in effect, and we both pay a 20% rate on our income. Bill Gates would be paying close to 100% of the taxes in that society. 99.99999% of the taxes. And so your talking head on Fox News could get on TV and go, it's unfair. Bill Gates is paying almost 100% of taxes in this society, right? But you get the absurdity of this. The reality is that the rich in America pay most of the taxes because they have most of the money. It's not because of the tax system being unfair, right? So that's the first thing to note, that if income was distributed more evenly, then the rich would pay a less share because other people would have more of the money and therefore pay more of the taxes. So moving on, a big thing of misconception that I notice, and I see this in journalism and in discussions, is what marginal rates mean and the extent to which the U.S. system is progressive and or not. Remember, what marginal rates are, as you go up in income, your taxes increase on income above that cutoff point. So that's the first thing to keep in mind here, is that when you go from the 10% rate to the 15% rate, or the 25% rate to the 28% rate, it's only the income above the cutoff that gets subjected to the new amount. It's not your total income that gets subjected to the new amount, right? So marginal rates are exactly that. It's income at certain tiers. And the reality is that middle class and upper middle class income levels is where these tiers end, right? So the highest tax rate in the United States in the 30s, it's gone down to, I think, about 37% from 39% and under current law in the new bill, ends in a couple $100,000 range. Now, obviously, people making a couple $100,000 are wealthy by most standards, but the key thing to point out is that Someone making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 is going to be paying the same marginal rate on those dollars above that cutoff as someone making $5 million, $10 million, $100 million. So our progressivity is very, very minimal in the sense that it ends very low. And so I think a big component of a progressive taxation system in, you know, the next time the Democrats have the majority will be to increase the rates. So the rate might right now be 37 is the highest going forward. If you make 250 or 300 grand, we should have a 40% rate for money over $1 million and maybe a 45% rate over 5 million. And where it should end, I don't exactly know. Probably somewhere we should have a rate for people making $100 million, and that rate should probably be pretty high, maybe 60% marginal rate. And you'll hear pushback from the right saying that this is going to hurt economic growth, right? Hurt the job creators and hurt innovation. Again, this is just absolute nonsense. We have about a centuries of data showing GDP growth rates and productivity growth rates and marginal tax rates. And there's essentially no correlation. So we've had very high rates of GDP growth and productivity when marginal rates were incredibly high in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And we've also had some of the worst performing years, you know, in the 2000s when marginal tax rates have been historically low. So the notion that there's any kind of macro correlation here is just false. And also the reason that it just doesn't make any sense to think like that is think about the incentives here. It's all about incentives. If you're a very rich person and the government is talking about taking an extra 10 or even 20% of the marginal rates above $100 million, is that going to affect whether you want to open a new business or create a new technology that maybe your return on that will be 40 million instead of 50 million and you're already rich? That just doesn't make any sense. The notion that the Mark Zuckerbergs and the pharmaceutical company innovators and the Bill Gates are going to all of a sudden just pack it in and go, you know, live on their private island because marginal rates on the next 100 million go up 10 or 20% just makes no sense whatsoever. So that's kind of the meme that you'll hear from the right wing against marginal taxation, and it's just pure nonsense. So the final part I want to leave on this element of taxation is about capital gains rates and investment. And this is very important because what each of us individually think of as investments is not what economists think of investments on a macro level. And so let me talk about stock investments. So when I or you make a contribution to your 401k or your 403b or your IRA for your retirement planning, you're buying stocks or bonds, you rightly think of that as an investment in your retirement and you're expecting to get a rate of return. But 99 or 999 out of 1,000 times, that money is not actually going into building a new business. That money is not going to a corporation to hire new people and do new R&D. You're just buying the stock from someone else who holds it. So it's just basically papers being exchanged. And what is that paper? That paper says, I have a right to some of the future profits of that corporation. But the company has not gotten any more money. When we as individuals buy and sell stocks, we're not affecting actual real investment in the United States. It's only IPOs, initial public offerings and kind of initial investments, your kind of Shark Tank type stuff, that's actually leading to true investment as an economist would define it. And so when you hear the right wing talking about reducing taxes on capital gains and on investment, what they're really doing is reducing taxes on people who are gambling, like people who buy stocks and bonds and are just trading shells. And that's not going to help the economy. Enriching stock traders and people who are trading in Bitcoin or housing property, that's not helping true investment. So again, it's kind of a bait and switch because us as individuals think of it as investment. You can then say, see, you're helping boost investment, but you're not, right? The way to boost investment is to help boost demand, help to boost R&D, low interest rates. It has nothing to do with capital gains rates. And so, for example, you know, capital gains rates are slated to go down, and investment income to go up with the corporate income tax cut that the GOP has just done. But corporations are already sitting on trillions of dollars in cash, and there's just no evidence that we're going to see a big investment boom because all of a sudden their trillions of dollars is going to grow. And so what capital gains rates that are lower than income rates mean is that people who work for a living, people who go to a job, a 9-to-5, or a teacher, a plumber, a doctor, a lawyer, we pay much higher rates of taxation than people who just sit on the side gambling all day. And so what that does is incentivizes gambling. And if you want a society in which gambling is incentivized and work is disincentivized, then the GOP plan for low capital tax rates is your cup of tea. But I would recommend a equalization that making a dollar from the stock market or selling gold should be taxed at exactly the same rate as actually working for a living. And so after the break, I'll come back and talk about Social Security and Medicare taxes, because that's quite important to understand. Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm a tax man. Yeah, I'm the tax man. Okay, so let's wrap up this discussion on taxes with two really important pieces of the federal tax system. And the first is Social Security. So Social Security is taxed at about 6.2% of income, but only up to about $124,000 of taxable federal income. So what this means is that the Social Security taxation system is incredibly regressive. So somebody who makes $124,000 in taxable income pays the exact same amount in dollars and cents as Bill Gates, or somebody who makes hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So whereas the very rich pay an almost insignificant, minuscule percentage of their income in taxes, someone in the middle class or lower income pays the full 6.2%. This is essentially the whole story of the financial future of Social Security. Social Security is much more financially robust than medical spending. And so that's why when I hear people lump Social Security and medical spending into one, I'm always very suspicious, because they're actually quite different. And Social Security is actually financially stable for many decades into the future, and simply increasing that amount of money that's subject to the payroll Social Security tax would make Social Security viable indefinitely. And so the only reason that Social Security has financial problems in the future is because of that cutoff. And I also want to point out that Social Security benefits have already been cut for the current generation that is, you know, before retirement age. The retirement age has been raised from 65 to 67, which means that all of us who have yet to get our benefits have 2 years less of benefits that we're going to be receiving. So when you hear talk about cutting Social Security, it's important to know that it already has been cut, and there's no reason to cut it in the future if you simply raise that cap and make the system less regressive. So that's just an important point, and I think Social Security is a great program that's really reduced elderly poverty in the United States. It helps the poor, it helps women, it helps widows, it helps the disabled. It's a great program. And given how great it is, expect the GOP to come after it soon. Moving on to medical taxation and medical spending, this is where the big deal is. So if you look at projected medical spending and government medical spending, so this would be Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Administration, it portends a pretty bleak financial picture for the U.S. because medical spending is increasing much faster than economic growth, which means just mathematically that it's going to become a bigger share of the government accounts and really dwarf all other things, which will lead to really only a few possible options. One would be to cut medical care for large segments of the population, even beyond what we already have, which is the Republican plan. They want to take away health care from people. The other would be to increase taxes radically, and that certainly is not a great thing, and that would be very costly. The solution that I think we all should focus on, and it actually should appeal to true conservatives, not these right-wing extremists, but a true conservative, would be to reduce medical costs. Because the reality is that America spends about twice as much per capita on average relative to other industrialized nations. And so we're just getting ripped off. We get bad outcomes and we spend a lot of money for it, which is the definition of getting ripped off. And if US medical spending was in line with the rest of the world, the deficit would go away. The long-term financial deficit of the United States would essentially disappear if our healthcare spending was in line with everybody else's. And so that's the whole game. And it's very simple why our system is not in line with the rest of the advanced nations. And that's because we have a much lower government role. And if you take the government out of healthcare, you get profiteering. And given the fact that when people are sick, they're desperate and they don't have sufficient information to know if they're getting a good deal because doctors and hospitals and drug makers have way more information than us, and we're vulnerable when we're sick and we just want to get better. Also, the way the insurance system works, we're shielded from a lot of the costs, and therefore, hospitals will charge insurance companies high amounts of money, and we have just a really perverse, distorted system. And so that's just the logic of capitalism. Capitalism and illness and disease means profiteering and poor quality. It's just as simple as that. There is no advanced nation in the world that doesn't have a strong government role in the healthcare system, except the United States. We certainly have a role, but it's a weak role. Other countries either have a single payer system where the government is actually the employer of hospitals and doctors, or they have a very strongly regulated quasi-private system, which is more your Singapore and your Switzerland model. And in those countries, they have great healthcare, which mu with much lower costs, and that's the way forward. Because the current way we tax healthcare or tax individuals to pay for healthcare is just the 1.45 Medicare tax that is on all income. And then we have Obamacare added on a Medicare surcharge, which is an additional tax on very wealthy individuals. So Obama did make medical taxation more progressive, which is really one of the, at the heart of the Affordable Care Act. But again, those taxes are just insufficient to cover the escalating exponential costs of healthcare. And we have to focus on the cost side. And the only way to focus on the cost side is through government intervention. And so, with the right wing kind of in this kind of crazy, extremist, laissez-faire, get the government out of everything mode, they're not, the ones with the solution. We need a strong, liberal, progressive, policy either for single payer or more kind of a Singapore model. And if we can get those costs down, then we won't have to increase people's taxes to pay for the costs.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Okay, so moving on to another issue that's a pet peeve of mine is the misuse of approval ratings in journalism. And the first example I want to use of really just incredible misinformation is the approval ratings that have been used to describe Obamacare since its inception. So after Obamacare passed in 2010, all the time we've been kind of inundated and bombarded with approval ratings, most of the time showing that a majority of Americans disapprove or do not approve of Obamacare. So you'll see, you know, 53% disapprove, 47% approve. That has changed a little the last year. It might be because Democrats now want to defend it under the Trump administration, or maybe people who are realizing they might lose some benefits or feeling like, hey, Obamacare is not such a terrible thing. So it has creeped into the low 50s. But really, the narrative that you heard in the media was the Democrats did this, you know, this thing called Obamacare and tried to get health care to people, and yet it's just not popular. They haven't been able to sell it, and it's an unpopular program, right? That was the narrative. But if you dug one level deeper, and this is the suggestion here, is that ask yourself and look at the statistics, why are people disapproving? So if you look at this with Obamacare, the roughly 50% of people who disapprove, about half of those, or 25%, wanted a more progressive or liberal healthcare system, and therefore Obamacare didn't go far enough. So to actually tell the story in a full, comprehensive way, the right way to inform people would have been to say 3/4 of Americans either approve of Obamacare or don't think it went far enough and therefore should be more liberal. So when you say it like that, which is the exact same statistics, you realize that, you know, we have a massive, huge majority in favor of a more progressive liberal healthcare system. It's only about 1/4 of the people in America who really want no healthcare from the government at all and kind of want government out. That's a much different narrative, right? And so it was the laziness of not just going that one extra step and going, the people who disapprove of Obamacare is not because they wanted government out or they didn't like some of the things of Obamacare, but they were frustrated it didn't go far enough. And that's a much different reality than just saying most people don't like Obamacare. The same thing applies to approval ratings of Trump, but this way, in a not so happy direction. So everyone is, you know, focused on the fact that Trump has these historic low approval ratings, which he of course does, and they're in the 30s to maybe low 40s. And I think a lot of people on the left have lulled themselves into a complacency that, oh, well, he never can get reelected and he, you know, everyone hates him. Again, we have to dig a little deeper. Why is it that people disapprove of him? Clearly, a lot of them disapprove of him because he's an evil white supremacist lunatic, which is a rational reason to disapprove of the president. But there's a good cohort, and we don't have data on this because journalists are generally lazy and don't ask the correct follow-up questions. But there's a large number of people who are disapprove of Trump because he hasn't gone far enough, because he hasn't built the wall, because he hasn't kicked all the Mexicans out, right? So if a lot of Trump's disapproval, or at least a significant portion, is coming from people who don't think he's racist enough or crazy enough, those aren't people who are going to vote for sane leaders in 2020. Those aren't people on the sane team. And so again, this really low disapproval rating, or I mean very low approval, high disapproval rating for Trump might mask the fact that there's still a huge amount of crazy out there, right? All the people who disapprove of Trump are not necessarily people who are going to vote for Trump's opponent, right? And so this is why we just can't drop the ball here, and we need to put forth an affirmative vision. So before I end this segment and flip to the next break here, I want to talk about one of my real pet peeves here, which is the number of counties that flipped from Obama. They had voted for Obama, and then they voted for Trump, and as somehow evidence that Trump's appeal is not racism. Because after all, if you voted for a black man and then you voted for Trump, how could you, you know, be racist? So let's just get a few things out of the way first. First is, I am sure there are individuals who actually voted for Obama once or twice and then voted for Trump. It's a big country, 330 million people, and there's a lot of reasons why people do things. I have no doubt that there are those individuals out there, okay? But there's also a couple other things that were going on. In many of those counties, whether, you know, rural Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or Ohio, that went for Obama in 2012, but Trump in 2016, we could, that exact result could have happened because, you know, Democratic Obama voters didn't turn out in as high numbers, which we know is true. Hillary didn't inspire a lot of people, and a lot of the Democratic left stayed home or voted for third parties. And then also Trump energized a kind of regressive white nationalist base. And so his numbers were way up compared to people who weren't really psyched on a plutocrat like Mitt Romney. So the point being is, while there obviously are some individuals who voted for Obama and then Trump, a lot of the story is simply in those counties, Democrats didn't show up because they were, you know, not feeling inspired. And a lot of white people who weren't inspired by Mitt Romney were inspired by Trump. And so that's a much more complicated picture. The final point here is racism isn't as simple as if you voted for Obama, you can't be a racist, right? Like, that's the most ridiculous, infantile view of racism, right? Racism works on many levels. It's subconscious levels. It's implicit levels, right? There's a lot of people who have a black friend or a Hispanic coworker who they like and respect who are still racist to those groups, right? You could have a person who says, hey, this Mexican guy I work with in construction, he's an awesome guy, but the other ones are the ones that I'm worried about, right? And so we all kind of suffer from some tokenism and some ability to like or find common ground with individuals, but we can still have very racist attitudes towards groups. So the notion that someone who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump can't be racist is just nonsense. Maybe they voted for Obama because they didn't like Mitt Romney, or because they thought he was going to give them health care. And then when they were disappointed with Obamacare, they voted for Trump because he promised them something. And it's nothing to do with their racial attitudes at all. And so I just really want to push back against this notion that places that voted for Obama happened to go for Trump this time means something deep about racial issues. It just doesn't. And statistically, a lot of those flips could have happened because of completely different groups of people who didn't flip, but just different turnout rates. So that's my pet peeve here, and just wanted to leave with that. And we'll take a break, and then I'll come out with my antidote for today. Okay, everybody. So to wrap up today's episode, my antidote for today, my suggestion for today, is to become an expert in the issue that you care about the most. And this could be healthcare or daycare or education or the justice system, equal rights, whatever it is. And, you know, I'm a public policy professional. I get paid to delve into the details and write and teach about this stuff. So I kind of get a pretty good, awareness and overview of a lot of issues, but I don't expect, you know, average citizens to be able to do that. And it's just overwhelming to really try to become an expert in everything. And that doesn't mean, however, that you can't be an expert in something. And so I'm urging everyone to go a little deeper. Whatever it is, the issue that you're into, become more informed so that you can make better comments on social media. You can have better conversations with your friends and family. You can be more informed about ballot initiatives or candidates that come up and help people make good choices in terms of voting, right? And so, and also to beat back propaganda, because there's quick, you know, responses that all the opponents of progress will always have. And if you just know this kind of soundbite, superficial stuff, you're never going to be able to counter that well, right? You're always going to be stymied by the easy kind of cheap points that the right wing and opponents of progress will throw back at us. But if you just go that little deeper and become an expert, you'll be able to stand your ground and really be a good advocate for the causes you believe in. And so that's what I've tried to do today, is just kind of throw out there a couple big issues and show how kind of lazy journalism and you know, misinformation can really distort perceptions of really big things. And we don't want any of that going forward. We got to be on the top of our game. And so that's what I'm advocating. So with that, I hope you enjoyed this episode and you'll rate it and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and Stitcher. And recommend the podcast to your family, friends, and colleagues, and share it on social media if that's your thing. So with that, everybody, I hope you have a great rest of the week. Take care and do good works.